Om sahana bhavatu, sahana bhunaktu, saha viryam karavavahai, tejasvinapatitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti.
All right, we're on verse 257. Vyachakshatante shastrani, vyachakshatante shastrani, vedan adhyapayantuva. Vedan adhyapayantu va yetradhikarino metu, yetradhikarino metu, nadikaro kriyatvataha, nadikaro kriyatvataha. Vyachakshatam te shastrani, vedan adhyapayantu va ye atra, ye atra adhikarinaha me tu na adhikaraha akriyatvataha.
Okay. Now remember, this section is now going, has been and is going to just be talking about the fruits, the pulla of having this knowledge of moksha. What's the moksha pulla? What's the fruit of having this knowledge? And also, how does one who has this knowledge think? What are they like? And so Vidyaranya is thinking, well, what am I like? And going through, you know, and just giving some really interesting verses here. So here he says, Vyachakshatam te shastrani. Let those people teach, expound upon the shastra, the Vedanta shastra, for instance. Let those people expound upon the Vedanta shastra, unfold the shastras. Shastrani, so all of the different shastras, all of the different scriptures and sciences, but particularly Vedanta Shastra, who are adhikarinaha, who are qualified to do that. In other words, if somebody's an Advaita Vedantin and has been taught properly in the Sampradaya, that person is qualified to teach, let that person teach it. If the person's in Jyotisha and qualified to teach Jyotish and they want to do that, let them teach that. They're an adhikara. They're qualified for that. And he says, Vedan adhyapayantu va. Or those people who are those people who teach the Vedas, especially the first part of the Vedas, for the chanting and the recitation of the Vedas, the understanding of all of the rituals. So let those people who are qualified for teaching that, let them teach that. But then he says, but for me, I'm not an adhikara. I don't have qualification in those things. Why? Because akriyatvataha. Because of being actionless. Because the atma is actionless. I don't have any qualification in any of these things. So now we have to understand what that means, right? It means he is not. He's saying I'm free of kriya. I'm free of action. Because of being free of action, I don't have any adhikara. There's nothing about the atma that is going to be involved or involved in doing anything. Right? Because the atma is free from karma and it's free from this kartritva, this sense of doership. And so now this means, really, if we kind of expand upon this a little bit, for the jnani, you're going to be impelled to do what is true to your prarabdha. In other words, what gives the impetus, even for jnani, ajnani, what gives the impetus to do anything, to take any type of action, to get involved in any type of commitment, any type of study? You have to have a desire for it. You know, I want to do this. There has to be some impetus. You could say even like this, if we're looking at it just in terms of prarabdha, either I have a desire to get involved in something, I want to do this, or somebody else has a desire to do it. May you please teach me? Could I please learn from you? Or something happens in the creation itself that generates a situation where you find yourself involved in that situation. That's how the prarabdha unfolds for jnani, for ajnani. And so there has to be an impetus. So if here he says, these people are teaching these shastras, they have an adhikara for that, they're qualified for that, also that's their prarabdha. That's what's, they are engaged, they find themselves engaged in that activity. These people are teaching the, they're teaching, say, the Vedanta, or they're teaching the Vedas, that's their karma. They have an icha. Icha means like a desire. They have a pravritti. Pravritti means an inclination to do that. They don't do that. For me, there's no such inclination. Right? For the in terms of the jiva upadhi, there's no such prarabdha. If there's no such prarabdha, nothing's going to be involving me in that activity. And so really now, another way of saying this is that as one becomes settled in their knowledge, the things that you find yourself as a jiva, this body, mind, sense organs, involved in, is your prarabdha, it's Ishwara. Right? Because in reality, there's one self, there's one Atma, which is my being, and there's one manifest creation. And this manifest one, or we call infinite knowledge, manifestation of knowledge, which is Ishwara, the whole manifestation of knowledge. That manifestation of knowledge includes all of us. Everybody is part and parcel of that. And so there's kind of an interconnected, infinite story going on here, of which all beings are a part. And so for each being, you find yourself in a situation, you find yourself in a life. In fact, your prarabdha, is that life. The prarabdha is more than just your body, mind, sense organs. It's also the life that surrounds you, because the prarabdha is unfolding. It's not just like, you know, the individual unfolds and nothing else is happening here. When the individual's life unfolds, that means the situation unfolds. And then you will find yourself part and parcel of that situation, including the necessary desires to engage you in the situation, either desires coming from you or from another person, or from the situation itself, forces an engagement. So that's how you find yourself, you know, involved in the situation. Otherwise, you're just kind of like a stone sitting there. It has no relationship to you. That isn't true. You find that this is my life. This is the life that I am involved in, and that I have certain duties. So, certain duties, certain engagements, certain responsibilities, certain just things that come to me. In fact, some jnanis will think, you know, whatever comes to me, well, Swamiji himself has said, whatever comes to me, that I do, and I do it to the best of my ability. That's the prarabdha, that's what's coming to me. You can look at your life like that. Your life is coming at you continually. You know, you don't really have to run after it. Right? You're surrounded by your life. It's very active. The life is very active. It's engaging you all of the time. So just what life demands on you will keep you plenty busy. You know, and so for Swamiji or for many jnanis, they just, all they do is keep busy with the responsibilities at hand, what life is giving them. And so then that would be, if I'm looking how Vidyaranya has to be meaning this, that's my adhikara. In other words, that's my qualification, that's my responsibility, is what is here life is giving me. Those people who have the adhikara in teaching the Vedas, you know, or in teaching the Shastra, then that's what they will be doing. But for me, this is the life that's unfolding. But from the standpoint of the Atma, I'm not doing anything. And so what is happening? There's an unfoldment of prarabdha, which is Ishwara. Right? The unfoldment of the prarabdha is Ishwara. We say Ishwara Srishti. That's Ishwara's creation. What we do as ajnanis is superimpose our jiva srishti on top of that. And then we'll say, well, this is happening like this, and I don't really think it should be happening. I think this should be happening, or I don't like it that this is happening. I think I should move over here somehow and make this happen. That's the jiva srishti projecting on top of the Ishwara srishti. You know, and so say you don't have the jiva srishti. It's not I should be doing this, or I should be doing that, or I need this, or I need that. That type of mindset is not there, or very well cannot be there, or if it is there, it's only like a dagda bija, like a burnt seed. It doesn't have any power. because of the strength of what is actually here, what is actually happening, which is your prarabdha karma, which is Ishvara. So here he's saying, you know, this is my prarabdha is not at this point when you take this life. That prarabdha is Ishvara. This life is happening. This is the given thread. That's Ishvara. I am not doing this. I'm not creating this prarabdha. Like, it's not my choice. It's not like saying, I'm not creating the prarabdha as I go along. I, the Atma, am akriya. I'm akarta. I'm not doing anything, you know. And so this is not my adhikara. That's not my responsibility. It's not my engagement. I am free, in fact. So whose responsibility, whose engagement is Ishvara, the prarabdha. And so whatever comes to me that I find myself engaged in, and that's what I find myself doing. These people find themselves teaching the Vedas. These people find themselves teaching the Shastra. If that was my prarabdha, that's what I would find myself doing too. That's how you have to take that. Okay? So, then he goes on. Nidra bhikshe snana shoche. Nidra bhikshe snana shoche. Nechami na karomicha. Nechami na karomicha. Drashtarasche kalpayanti. Drashtarasche kalpayanti. Kim me syat anya kalpanat. Kim me syat anya kalpanat. Nidra bhikshe snana shauche. Na ichami na karomi cha. Drashtaraha chet kalpayanti. Kim me syat anya kalpanat. Okay, thinking from the last, bringing the last verse forward. For the jnani, this and my engagement in this creation is Ishvara. The body, the mind, the sense organs, the prarabdha karma, the ahankara, all of it is mithya. And you know what I mean? All of it is mithya. It's all part of the manifest creation. The manifest creation is Ishvara. Well, the ajnana, the ignorance is this. I am with a kartritvam of my atma, my being, is this. I am this. And if I am this, then I am different from this. Right? So instead of seeing all of this as myself, that kartritvam, that doership comes in, you know, the ahankara, the I notion comes in and attaches to this physical body or this mind, and I become the doer, the enjoyer, the one who is responsible for carving my way out into the world and all of that. Here, Vidyaranya is saying, I am the Atma myself, this me, is akriya. This, my sense of self, I never change. I'm not a karta. I'm not doing anything. I'm always exactly the same. And that's my self-experience. And then all of this, this body, mind, sense organs, and the life I find before me becomes Ishvara. And so I'm engaged in this life. As long as I have this body, mind, sense organs, I have a mind, I think, I see, you know. I have the ahankara in a dagdabija form, in a burnt seed form, where I can have the sense of I am doing this because this body is here that reflects consciousness, the chitta-bhasa, the reflection of consciousness. I have a mind that thinks, right? So my mind is thinking, it's not your mind. And so since it reflects consciousness, right? This chitta-bhasa, this reflection of consciousness, this entity, has the sense of doership and enjoyership, all the while myself being stable, being changeless, being free, being full. And so that's where he's speaking from, that self-recognition. And so here he says, sleeping, nidra, bhiksha, eating, sleeping and eating, nidra, bhiksha, it's a dwandra compound for this, you know, Sanskrit, nidra, bhiksha, sleeping and eating, which are worldly, so just secular things that we have to do to keep alive. Then he says, snana, bathing and saucha, purification. This bathing and purification are things that I do. Not that we don't just normally bathe, but here when you say the bathing and purification, these are things that are done before you begin a ritual, right? A Vedic ritual. So the things that I do in order to, this is from the Bhasha, in order to get to better worlds or to do my responsibilities to make sure that I get to a better world or have a better birth next time in dharmas. So he says both of these things, the secular ones of, you know, sleeping and eating, and then the bathing and purifications, he says, I don't want any of these things. Na ichami. I don't want them. I don't have a desire for them. I have no desire for them. Nor do I do them. He says, na ichami. I don't have a desire for these things. Na karomi cha. Nor do I do them. I don't have a desire for them, and I don't do them. Then he says, drashtaraha chait. He says, if drashtaraha, the onlookers, drashtaraha are those people who are seeing me do things. Those people who are looking on, they see me eating, you know, they see me sleeping, they see me doing this, these purificatory rites, they see me doing these, the bathing, all of these. These people who are looking on, they're, if these people who are looking on, kalpayanti, if they project these things on me, people who are looking, if they project these things, he says, kim me syat, what is that to me? What does that do to me? The people are saying, you know, oh look, you're eating, you're eating, you're sleeping, you're bathing, you're performing these rituals, you're doing this and you're doing that. If the people are projecting all of this on me, kim me syat, what does that do to me? What happens to me? He says, anya kalpanat, what happens to me because of another's projection? Anya means another. Kalpana means a projection. Because somebody's projecting something, there's a projection of somebody. Somebody else is projecting something. How does that affect me? What does that do to my atma? What does that do to the self? Does the self all of a sudden start to become somebody who sleeps and bathes, you know, and eats? Does the self all of a sudden sees, you know, oh, this person here is eating. Does that mean they projected eating on my being? Does that mean that the atma starts eating because of this person's projection? The person says, look, that person is eating. Well, that's their projection. That's what they see. That's their imagination. That the conscious being that you are is a karta, is somebody who is doing or enjoying. It's just like, you'll probably get to this later, though I haven't seen it yet. It's just like if somebody is looking at you, you're a jnani, you know yourself. Actually, it's true for everybody, but we'll just talk about those who recognize it. And they say, oh, you are sad, you are happy, you are angry, you are agitated. Or in reference to the body, you are healthy, you are sick, you are this, you are that. All of these things are projecting the self, the atma, onto the upadhi. The person who's seeing you like that means they've projected in their mind the atma is the upadhi, is the conditioning agent. And so then they see the upadhi doing all of these things. They see the body, you know, eating and sleeping. Then you are eating and sleeping. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you are the body. Mm-hmm. They see the mind doing this and that and the other thing. Then you are doing this, that and the other thing. You are feeling this way. You are thinking this way. Because there's no viveka, there's no recognition of the self, right? Which is free and stable in spite of all of that. You have to remember that Vidyaranya is teaching. He's teaching. We're not going to walk around thinking, you know. You don't walk around, you know, thinking, oh, look, this person is looking at me as though I'm eating. You know, of course the person is looking at you as though you're eating, because from the standpoint of your upadhi, you are eating. And from, you're also going to say, what are you talking about? I'm eating. Of course I'm eating. I'm sleeping. Of course I'm sleeping. You yourself as a jnani will say, yes, I'm eating. I'm sleeping. And I'm not doing anything. But that part you're not going to say. But you're not going to say that because that part is reserved for teaching. That's not a part that you carry around with you you know, as part of the vyavahara, as part of the conversation in empirical reality, you know, yes, I know, dear, I know that it looks like I'm sleeping and that I'm eating, but you know, I'm really not. Even though I might say that I'm sleeping, and I'm really not, because the self is not, you know, is always stable and it's always the same. So that doesn't enter into the vyavahara conversation. And Vidyaranya jokes about that in the earlier place. It's important to know that, because people get all these funny ideas. But so here you have to understand what he's saying. No amount of projection is going to change the reality, even your own projection. Even if, say if you have, talking just from the standpoint of a jnani, say you yourself have knowledge. You recognize the aparokshatvam, you recognize the stability of your own being. That's the constant. And sometimes because of your vasanas or because of your samskaras or tendencies, you yourself get lost, you know, in samsara. You take yourself to be a jiva. You get into that, you know, emotional state of being caught up in the creation, and the stability of yourself seems to be overshadowed by the emotional situation that you find yourself in. Have, in fact, in spite of that, has anything happened to you? Has yourself, even with your own projection, has your being become engaged in whatever is going on at any time? You say no. Your being has never at any time become engaged, nor will it ever become engaged. You are always free. You are always stable. And so if your mind gets lost for a few minutes, it'll work that out. It'll come back, relax, and say, oh, thank God. You know, have you ever been? This is a little tangential, but it just makes me think of it. Have you ever had, you know, one of those dreams that are kind of a scary nightmare? And it's like the worst thing that could happen. And then you wake up, and then you think, oh, thank God. It was only a dream. It was only a dream. No. I had one not too recently, but not too long ago either. I don't remember when. But it was a dream where I had lost my purse. And it was really real. I had lost it, and I was searching all over it, and I realized this purse is gone, and then I was going through all of the things I was going to have to do, and kind of the nightmare of the whole thing. You know? And then I woke up, and I thought, oh my God, I think that was only a dream. And then I realized, you know, I thought for a minute, this was only a dream. I really didn't lose my purse, and I was so darn relieved. I was so relieved. So now, knowledge is like that. Once you have knowledge, once you know yourself, say you're still working things out, right? You still have samskaras. Samskaras means you still have tendencies. You still can get engaged in the world and taken for a ride. You can still become hurt. You can still become unhappy. But your mind can't hold that ajnana. It can't hold that state. Even when you have no knowledge, your mind can't hold an emotional state or a situation. It will pass. All states pass. All emotional states pass. Anything, in fact, any experience within the creation, any experience on an emotional level, on a thought level, on a physical level, all of it passes. You don't have to worry about it. You can say, oh, I'm so happy. My mind is so happy right now. That's all right. That'll pass. Don't worry. My mind is so unhappy right now. Okay? Yeah, that'll pass too. My mind is agitated. That'll pass too. It doesn't make any difference what it is. It definitely will pass. If you have knowledge, you can help it. You can help it to pass just by the recognition of what's going on. That will help it to pass. But even with or without knowledge, it will pass. The overwhelm will pass, whatever it is. And then what are you left with? Your knowledge. Knowledge doesn't go away. And so it's kind of like waking up from a dream and say, oh my God, what was that? You know? It's an overwhelm. And so now what he's not focusing so much on that happening for himself, he's just saying, you know, someone sees you when they see you, they see the upadhi. And if they take that to be you, you know, they see you eating, they see you sleeping, they see you bathing, they see you going through purificatory rites. You know, they project that on you. That's what it is. It's the anyonya adhyasa. They project it on themselves, they project that on you. Mm-hmm. So, does anything happen to you because of that? But no. So he gives an example. He says, Gunja punja di dahyeta, Gunja punja di dahyeta, nanyaropita vannina, nanyaropita vannina, nanyaropita samsara, nanyaropita samsara, dharmaneva aham bhaje, dharmanevam aham bhaje. He says, gunja punja adi dahyeta na anyaropita vannina, na anyaropita samsara dharman, evam aham bhaje. So here he gives another example like this. He says, this gunja punja, it's a type of a plant with dark red berries. It's like a bush. So say if you have a bush of this gunja plant, it's like a heap of like a bush. Like a bush of the gunja plant. It has these little dark red berries. So there's a big bush of it. Or something similar, he says. Say that is dahyeta. Say, he says, this gunja plant, dahyeta na. This gunja plant, this gunja bush, it is not going to burn. It's not going to burn. Anya aropita aropita vanina. By a fire which somebody projects on it. Right? If there's a bush there, you know, and somebody has projected fire on it. Say, oh, look, there's fire on that bush. Is that bush going to burn? Nothing will happen. The person sees the fire on the bush, but it's a projection. It's fire that's been projected. Can a projected fire, can an imagined fire, you know, burn the bush? Because this has these dark red berries, you know, it can reflect in the light as though there's fire. And so you can say, oh, look, this bush is burning. I see the fire. You see the fire. The bush is burning. Is it possible? Is it possible for a projection, you know, to affect the what we call the adhishtana? There's the aropa and the adhishtana. The adhishtana is the thing that is actually there, right? The aropa is the thing that's projected on it. So here, the gunja bush is the adhishtana. It's the thing that is actually there. The aropa is the projection of the fire. The fire is the projection. Can the aropa, can the projection touch what is actually there? No. Can't do anything. So here, this adhishtana aropa, the adhishtana, say, for instance, in the rope snake. The rope is the adhishtana. That is what is actually there. Because of which this projection can take place. Without the adhishtana, there is no aropa. The projection requires the adhishtana. So without the rope, there's not going to be a snake. The adhishtana is the post in the dark that has the projection of a ghost. Without that post, projected on it is a ghost or a robber or, you know, or a man in the dark. That post is the adhishtana for the projection. Does the rope become snake? No. Does it even know about the snake? No. Does the post become the ghost? No. Nothing happens. Does the sand become the mirage water? No. So between the adhishtana and the aropa, that's a satya mitya connection. Right? The mitya can't do anything in any way. Can it touch the adhishtana? So here, so he says, you know, just like this ganja bush, it's not possible for it to be burned by the projection of somebody on a fire on it. Somebody projects fire on it, it's not possible for it to burn. Then he says, similarly, he goes, in the same manner, the samsara dharmas, the qualities of samsara, the samsara dharmas, you know, like being subject to time, being subject to change, being mortal, being subject to sukha and dukkha, all of these things that are projected upon me, all of these dharmas of samsara, he says, that are projected by somebody. So he says, na anya, that means another person, aropita, that which is projected, samsara dharman. The samsara dharmas, which are projected by somebody else, in the same manner, aham na paje, I don't partake of those. Paje means I don't have those. I don't take those on. I don't become those samsara dharmas that are projected by somebody else. And so if somebody says to you, you know, Shankara has talked about this in chapter 13 of the Gita, the only one really that knows whether you are free is you and your guru. Because your guru is free, the teacher has given you that knowledge, and then that teacher can know, whether you've recognized. Mm. Not necessarily anybody else. Because anybody else is going to project the samsara dharmas upon you. If you blink improperly, you know, we do this all of the time anyway, you know, somebody, just without even knowledge, somebody, you know, raises their eyebrow in the wrong way, you know, or is distracted thinking about something, and you look at them and then you project whatever you project on them. That's that aropita. You project upon the adhishtana of the raised eyebrow, right, your reality, right? And so say the person by samsara dharmas are just all dharmas that the body, the mind, the sense organs enjoy, that the samsara dharmas are the upadi dharmas. As long as you have this body, you have these dharmas of the body, the qualities of the body. As long as you have a mind, you have what belongs to the mind. As long as you have sense organs, you know, you have what belongs to the sense organs. What if you're losing your eyesight? Then the person, oh, that poor person's losing, you're losing your eyesight. You know, say you're going deaf, oh, you're going deaf. Say your body is getting old, boy, you're growing old. These are the samsara dharmas. Oh, you have such a pleasing personality. Does Bhagavan, does Atma have a pleasing personality or displeasing personality? Atma is the self of the pleasing and the displeasing personality, right? So Atma is beyond pleasing or displeasing personality. Atma is the self that's there as the truth of all of the personalities. Atma is yourself is the one that's there, the truth of whatever the state of the body is, whatever the state of the mind is. Those states of the upadis are the samsara, what he means by the samsara dharmas. So those samsara dharmas, qualities, those are projected, if those that are projected like that by somebody else, in the same manner as this ganja tree, what does it do to me? I don't, he says, aham bhaje, aham na bhaje, I don't have those samsara dharmas. I don't have them. I don't partake of those. That's not myself. Right? So, that's his example. So then he goes of himself using the ganja tree in the previous verse. So now he goes, shrinvan twagnya, shrinvan twagnya tatatvaste, shrinvan twagnya tatatvaste, janan kasmat shrinomyaham, janan kasmat shrinomyaham, manyantam samshiyapannaha, manyantam samshiyapannaha, namanyeham asamshayaha, namanyeham asamshayaha. Shrinvantu agnyata tatvaha te. So shrinvantu agnyata tatvaha te. Janan kasmat shrinomi aham. Manyatam samshaya apannaha na manye aham asamshayaha. He's now going to be looking at shravana, manana, niradhyasana, which is the sadhana for gaining this knowledge, shravana. He has goes to the teaching methodology, manana, of doubts, going through all of the doubts a person may have of why that might not be true, and niradhyasana is contemplation. So here he says, shrinvantu agnyata tatraha te. Let those people who are ignorant of the truth, tatva agnyata, right? Agnyata means is unknown. Those people for whom the tatva, the truth, is unknown. So those people who don't have self-knowledge, for those people for whom the truth is unknown, let them listen. Let them do shravana. They should do shravana, the people that don't know the self, that don't have knowledge, those people need to do shravana. Let them do the shravana, he says. But then he says, janan kasmat shrinomi aham. But I am somebody who knows. I know. Then for what reason should I do shravana? Why should I do shravana? Because I know. Let the people who don't know do shravana. Later in other places, and we'll often say, that doesn't mean you don't have, you can do shravana if you want, because you enjoy it. It's like looking in the mirror. Swamiji often said in this Viditatmananda used to say, you know, this being exposed to the pramana is so pleasing. It's as pleasing, you know, as people who look, you always want to look at your face in the mirror. So when you're exposed to this pramana, it's holding up a mirror to yourself. So it's a very pleasing experience. So people will go on listening just to revel in this vision. But once you have this vision, you don't need to do that. You know, you don't need to do it to get this vision. You do it because there's a lot of joy in doing it. But I don't have to do it. For what reason would I do that? So he says, kasmat, why? Why would I listen? And if you were to answer that, well, let's see, why would I listen? Well, because it's like looking in the mirror. It's ananda. But I don't listen to gain knowledge because I already have knowledge. Let the people who don't have knowledge, for those people, they should do shravana. Let them do shravana. Then he says, manyantam samshya apanaha. Let those people who have doubts, samshaya means doubts, apanaha, they've gained doubts, they're listening, they're doing the shravana, and as they do the shravana, their mind will go, yeah, but couldn't it be like this? Or why does it, the shastra says it's like this. You understand what the shastra is saying through the shravana, but then you say, you know, but the Buddhists say it could be like this, why isn't it like that? You know, or the Sankhya say, it's like this, why shouldn't it be like that? Or the secularists say, you know, the materialists say it should be like this. Or I might have my own doubts. I think it's like this. This is how I've grown up. Or in my own reflections, I've always thought it was like this. Why wouldn't it be like this? That's for those are doubts. And for those doubts, you need to do manana. And there's many different levels of doubts, like even doubts including that are referring to your state of mind. If I have these emotions, do these emotions negate my knowledge? How could I be a jnani and have an emotion like this? How could I be a jnani and then find myself upset? I must not be a jnani if I'm upset. Is that true, Swamiji? Is that true? Am I not a jnani because my mind is upset? Can I be upset and still be a jnani? That's a doubt. It means you don't know. That's a doubt. So there's all kinds of doubts. So the Shastra, believe me, the Shastra goes through all of them. You know, if you have a doubt, you won't be the first one that's had the doubt. And somewhere in one of these texts or in one of the bhashas, Shankara or somebody else will be going into in discussion. Just like, that's why everybody loves this Panchadashi, because this is only one chapter. It's 15 chapters.
Yeah.
And he just goes, you know, he just goes through all of the conceivable doubts, as does Shankara and his bhashas. You know, so if you have a doubt, if there's a doubt is occurring, then, you know, let the person do who has the doubt, then, you know, those people should do manana. They're supposed to do manana. That's what it's there for. He says, Na manye aham asamshayaha. I don't have a doubt. My doubts are cleared. They're gone. You know, I understand. I don't have a doubt. If a doubt came up, I would do manana. But I am asamshayaha. I am one who is free from doubts. So I'm not doing manana because I don't have anything to do manana on. You know, it's not like with this knowledge that you have to do, keep doing shravana, 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 because you will never know. In fact, you do shravana so that you will know. So there is such a thing as knowing. Once you know, then the purpose of shravana, to give knowledge, has done its job. Now you don't need to do shravana. Manana is to resolve all of the doubts that come up as you're understanding. Those doubts that come up, you know, are resolved. It's not like they go on infinitely. So all I have to do manana for the rest of my life. I have to do shravana for the rest of my life so that I can know, and then I have to do manana for the rest of my life so that I can clear these doubts that are like, you know, I was going to say like fleas, like cockroaches, that keep coming and coming and coming, and we have to keep cleaning them out, you know, cleaning them out because they keep multiplying and multiplying and multiplying. So we're stuck with this endless manana. Oh, these doubts come to an end, and then your mind, actually there's a really kind of interesting process where it starts out where the doubts that you have are many and varied, and they're real. Those doubts are, they have to be answered. You yourself don't have the answer. You have to ask Swamiji, you have to ask your teacher. You know, I really don't know. This is a real doubt. Then as time goes on, the doubt will come, but as it comes, then you'll think about it, and then the answer, you'll figure it out for yourself. That's another stage. Then another stage is, the doubt will come, but as it comes, the answer comes. You know, the question comes, and as the question comes, the answer comes. Right? The seeing, the clarity comes. Then what's the stage after that? There's only the answer there, there's not the doubt. Right? The understanding is there, not the doubt. But that means that thing is resolved. So when that's the case, then you don't have that doubt. So then how are you going to do manana? You have to make up a doubt that you don't have so that you can do manana. Or you teach. When you teach, then you're always naturally in the position of your student. Right? If you say this, because in your mind, this is the teaching methodology, in fact. If you say one thing, you're teaching your students, there's something to be said that you're going to unfold, but as soon as you start to unfold it, you realize, well, it's not possible for anybody to understand this unless this is said. So that has to be unfolded. You know, and then once that is unfolded, the next thing is available to be unfolded. Because that will make sense. And so, what happens to a student is always so interesting, it's so exciting. This used to happen to me all the time, to everybody, really. Because there's a progression like that you can't really understand this until this is understood, you can't understand this until this is understood. What happens with your mind is that the teacher will unfold something that will very frequently bring up the very next question, which is the next thing to be unfolded. You know, and that itself will bring up another question, which is the next thing to be unfolded. So it becomes very interesting when it becomes kind of magical, you know, because your mind will naturally move to the next logical conclusion. You know, your mind moves along to the next logical conclusion, and then, of course, the teacher unfolds the next logical conclusion. And so your wonderment is right in sync with the process of unfoldment. That's not always the case. Sometimes the unfoldment is going on and your mind went this way and the teacher's going this way, and then you're kind of, you have to wait for the teacher to come around again or take care of it in satsang. But the other happens also. So here he says, namanye, aham namanye, I'm not doing the manana because asamshayaha, I don't have any doubts. So it's another. Or nididhyasana, he goes. Vipariyasto nididhyase viparayasto nididhyase kinjanam aviparayayat kinjanam aviparayayat dehatmatva viparayasam dehatmatva viparayasam nakadachit pajamyaham nakadachit pajamyaham viparayastaha nididhyaset kim jnanam aviparayayat dehatmatva viparayasam na kadachit bhajami aham. He says, the viparayastaha is the one who has this erroneous conclusion. The erroneous conclusion is in nididhyasa, the dehatma buddhi, where there's an erroneous conclusion, a mistake where I take something unreal to be real. So that's I take the Atma to be the body to be the Atma. There's this, that's the viparya. You get everything in reverse, ulta. So it's a mistaken, it's an error, a mistake. So the one who has this erroneous conclusion of that the self is the body, that's the erroneous conclusion. This viparyastaha, that person, they should do nididhyasana, contemplation, because contemplation is meant to break through this dehatma buddhi, this conclusion that I am the body. Even though, you know, the shravana, the teaching goes on, the manana is there, I see it clearly, but then I keep feeling like I'm the body. The mind, that mutual superimposition seems to just stay there. Right, because my mind is so conditioned toward that. So for as long as that strong conditioning is there, then that person should do contemplation. Let the mind sit with the reality of myself. Let it get used to knowing me as free. Knowing me, recognizing me as changeless. Let the mind sit in contemplation where it can recognize that, have that viveka, where it recognizes itself as continually changing, the world, the mithya, is continually changing, and myself as that stable presence. Let it sit there and get used to me. You know, build a relationship with me, recognize me. You know, separate this superimposition. So such a person who has this erroneous conclusion, that person should do the nididhyasana. But kim jnanam, what, why meditation aviparayayat, for a person for whom that error is not there. You know, if there's, you know, because if there's, what, why meditation? Because aviparayayat, because there's no viparya. There's no erroneous conclusion. Because there's no erroneous conclusion is there, then why should I do nididhyasana? Why kim jnanam? Why jnanam? You can do it because you like to. Because it's ananda. You enjoy it. But you're not doing nididhyasana. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. These are the upayanishtas. This is... Upayanishta means... This is the direct means for gaining knowledge. Shravana, manana, nididhyasana. There's all kinds of upayanishtas. The karma yoga... pranayama, meditative techniques for citta ekagrata, single pointedness of mind, all of these things to gain a mind which is capable of holding this knowledge. Those are the upayanishtas. But the upayanishtas, like doing a lot of karma yoga, doing a lot of meditative exercises, pranayama, hatha yoga, all of these things, eating macrobiotically, Swamiji will sometimes joke, you know, eating brown rice. All of these things will make you healthy, will make bring the body and the mind into a certain state of adhikaritvam, of being qualified to gain this knowledge. But they won't give you the knowledge. All of these practices, they don't give knowledge, but they bring the mind into a certain level of, and the body into a level of shanti and peace and availability, so that when this knowledge just takes place, the mind is there to receive it. Those are the upayanishtas. The upayanishta is shravana, manana, nididhyasana. So these three are what actually give knowledge. These are what actually give the moksha. The Upayanishta, the Karma Yoga, all that has to be there so that the mind can receive this knowledge. But the direct means for self-knowledge is Shravana Manana Nididhyasana. So here he's gone through, why should I do Shravana? Right? Because, you know, I know the truth. I'm not an Ajnata Tattvaha. Ajnata, it is unknown, Tattvaha, the truth is unknown. I'm not that. I do know. Why should I do Shravana? Let the people who have doubts do Manana. I don't have any doubts. I'm Asamshayaha. I don't have doubts. I don't need to do the Manana in order to gain Nishta, to gain knowledge. Let the people who have the Dehatma Buddhi do contemplation, because Nididhyasana is what takes care of that. Let them do it. They should do Nididhyasana. I don't have a Dehatma Buddhi. That's not there for me. So why should I do jhanam? He says, what he says is, Dehatmatva viparyasam, this erroneous conclusion of the body being the mind, of the self being the body, this erroneous conclusion, na kadachit, never, bhajami aham. I don't ever have that at any time. I never have this dehatma buddhi at any time, kadachit. Na kadachit means never. I never have this. I never mistake myself. If I were to mistake myself, then I would do Nididhyasana right there on the spot. Right then and there, I'd do it. But, you know, I never have that. So why should I do Nididhyasana? And, in fact, one way of thinking about this, if that is true, you never have that, you're never not doing Nididhyasana because yourself is aproksha. Right? So that self-recognition is always there. You don't have to keep saying, oh, look at me, in order to be me. Just like a person walking around, an Ajnani walking around taking themselves to be the body, they don't walk around saying, look, I'm the body. They don't have to say that. They just know they're the body. Right? They don't have to say anything. The Jnani also, who has Nishta in the self is aparoksha, doesn't have to walk around saying, look, I'm the self. Don't forget I'm the self. Don't have to say anything. I am the self. I'm never not the self. All of the vrittis, all of my mind, all of my emotions are rooted in the aparoksha atma, which is, I'm totally awake to. That process is over. The nididhyasana that I've done, the shravana manana nididhyasana I've done, has done its job. Now I don't have a dehatma buddhi anymore. So why should I do jhanam? Except that it's fun to do. That's all. Okay, let's stop there. So he's going into a good section here. How many verses did I do? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, 5. Yeah, only 5.
We're not on a race.
No, but I'm trying. I want to finish it before I go. I need 5 each time.
You did a good job.
Thank you. Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Respond very well to this idea that we're always in contemplation if that recognition of myself is based upon knowledge. So there's no activity there.
Yeah.
No actualness. And that it sits there lightly, just like I am the body, sits lightly, you don't have to remind yourself. Same with this knowledge, you don't have to remind yourself once
the ignorance is removed.
Yeah.
That's what makes it sit lightly. It's a jnana, what we call jnanam, knowledge is the elimination of ignorance. Right? So here for self-knowledge, what self-knowledge actually is the elimination of ignorance, because you are already experientially here. Because you can think of knowledge as the gain of knowledge, instead of just the removal of ignorance. And say, if you think of it like the gain of knowledge, this palavyapti and vrittivyapti, for some of you who have been through this, the gain of knowledge is like, for instance, in order for me to know that painting, I have to gain a vritti of the painting, a thought of the painting through my eyes, say, in order to know the painting. It's because that I'm not walking around with the painting, it's not always there. In order for me to know the painting, I have to gain a thought modification true to the painting, right? Because the painting is away from me. See what I mean? And so then I could even have to remember it, because it's an object that I'm not. So I now, if I look away, I don't see the painting anymore. If I go outside, if I even go to school and I try to remember to visualize that painting, that may or may not be successful. I have to bring the memory back, bring the vritti back. I can forget it. But here, the Atma, yourself, is always present. It is the very self, in fact, that you've always taken it to be, you to be. Right? It's just that you've taken yourself to be the self, but you've dressed it in the body, the mind, the sense organs. And so yourself, the self that you've taken yourself to be, is the self. It's just like if the body dropped, you would still be there. Sense organs drop, you would still be there. Mind drops, you would still be there. And that's where the ignorance is. You have taken your being to be totally dependent on the upadis, on the body, mind, sense organs, as though they're a unit. Because this body, mind, sense organs is here, I am here. The body, mind, sense organs gives me me. It is responsible for my being. If the body drops, dies, then what is responsible for my being will be gone. I'll be dead, right? And so what happens with knowledge is that's an ignorance about your own nature that causes this superimposition. And so the mind is ignorant. It takes itself to be you, and then it takes itself to be a product of the body. And so what happens is that the mind recognizes, right, there's a removal of that ignorance. And then the mind is still there and still has the self for its self, but that self is free of the mind. It sees that, it recognizes it. And yourself is never not there, it's never not you. You know, it's the you that you've always known to be you, except now you realize that you are free. You thought that you were the body. You thought that, in the sense that if the body dies, I die. You thought that you were the mind. So whatever qualities the mind is going through, that's me. That's the firm belief. It's a commitment. That's a nishta. Your nishta is there. It's called, you know, it's a nishta. It's mityajnanam. It's a knowledge which is false. It's a cognition. It's a false cognition. But you can have nishta in that false cognition.
But you can have that false cognition and still know it's not true. I mean, you know.
Yeah, but here, it's not that you lose the cognition of the body, or the recognition of the body, the mind, the sense organs, right, all of your upadis. But what's different now is that you recognize yourself as free of that. The satyam mitya. The satyam mitya is that the mitya depends upon the satyam for its being. The pot depends on the clay for its being. But the satyam doesn't depend on the mitya for its being. It's not an equal relationship. So clay doesn't depend on pot. Pot depends on clay. My mind depends on me. I am the self of the mind. I am the self of the body. I am the self of the sense organs. Right? They totally depend upon me for their being, for their consciousness. I am their self. But, so that's the mitya depending upon the satyam. But the satyam doesn't depend on the mitya. My being is not dependent at all on my body or my mind or my sense organs. It's totally independent. It's totally free. Right? And so that's what I recognize.
Some kind of big question came in my mind, and I don't know if I can articulate it, but consciousness, Atma, it's not a thought. It's free from thought. And so, is it free from thought in the same way that, like, okay, I'm looking at that bookshelf, and I'm not thinking red, but red is seen, or red in the bookshelf.
Uh-huh.
And so, consciousness is not a thought. I'm not a thought, but the knowledge is there regardless of a thought, in the same way that consciousness is in a silent mind and not in a thought. A thought is in consciousness, but I don't know if I'm articulating it, but I'm trying to differentiate thinking from knowing, from knowledge. Is knowledge knowledge is in the mind?
If you're thinking knowledge in any form of any kind of duality, like say a thought doesn't have to be just an intellection where you're using words. You know, like say, thought does, that's a different type, that's a type of thought. There's many different types of thought. But any perception that comes and goes, you know, that's a vritti. There can be emotional vrittis, there can be perceptual vrittis, there can be imaginative vrittis, you can be thinking something through. Those are all different types of thought. All of those thoughts, whatever the different type of thought, all of those thoughts are known. Right? They're illumined. You're aware of them. Right? So the awareness which the thought that illumines the thought is different than the thought, in the sense that the thought comes and goes, the awareness doesn't.
Okay, but like let's just say the color red.
Yeah.
So red is a perception. Let's say I'm just looking and I'm not thinking that this and that and the other is red, but red is in the perception.
That's right.
Okay.
So but that perception is a thought.
In terms of consciousness, consciousness lights up red, but red is like, it's like a potential or a possibility within consciousness. It's like the knowledge, without being a thought.
It is, right? A thought. A perception is a thought.
Okay, so then consciousness
you can't
is
see
silence.
Yeah, but say you see that red book.
Mm-hmm.
You see that through your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Your eyes are focused on it, so now there's red.
Mm-hmm.
That is a thought. That's a perception.
Mm-hmm.
It's a thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then consciousness illumines that thought. Whatever the thought is.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be, you don't have to say, like say you see red. That's a thought. Then you can label it, this is red.
That's another kind of
thought.
That's
another kind of thought.
Mm-hmm. Then what about the witness? The witness is Atma.
Yeah.
Okay. Just, the witness is silence, consciousness.
Well, I'm saying for now that the witness is the Atma, but I want you to go
yeah,
on.
Yeah, it Atma, right.
Okay.
Okay.
Atma, we'll start there.
And thoughts happen in consciousness, so that it's a totally different thing. One is not thought, and the other is thought. Okay, I guess it makes sense. I mean, it's so obvious, but it's like, can I know the self, the Atma, without a thought? How do you do that? I mean,
okay.
Yes, it's obvious,
yeah,
but what is?
See, there's two things here. Because the self is consciousness, consciousness is known by its very nature. But it's known It's lit up. In other words, consciousness is conscious of itself because it's consciousness, not without duality. That's why we say it's self-evident. The example they use is like the sun. The sun doesn't need to bring in another sun to light it up. It's self-luminous. So it is its own light. So consciousness is its own light for everybody, even for animals and worms and insects and humans. For everybody, consciousness is its own light, and everybody will say, I am a conscious being. They're labeling that consciousness. Okay, so that doesn't need a thought. That is the very basis, the self-luminous self of all thoughts. Right? So you don't need any knowledge, you don't need anything to come and tell you that. It's your self-evident experience. Now, what you do need knowledge of is what the Vedanta points makes you see is that self-evident consciousness is free. That it is stable. It is the self of the thought, but it is free of the thought. It's the self of the perception, but free of the perception. And so you need to, the knowledge, the teaching methodology has to make you recognize that self-evident consciousness as self-evident consciousness, free from the body, free from the mind, free from the sense organs, the very self of the whole creation.
Right? It's funny how like a speck gets in there of thought consciousness. It's amazing how it's totally different, different.
Well, wait a minute.
Realms,
well, you have to be careful. Mm. When you say totally different, like say if we go back to the clay pot.
Mm-hmm.
The pot
different levels
is
of reality.
Okay, yeah, you can say different mm-hmm. level of reality, yeah. But you still, this clay pot rope snake you have to hold in juxtaposition. You use the clay pot to understand that there is no distance between the pot and the clay. There's no difference. There is no distance between myself and my mind, right? I am the clay of the mind. I am the self, the being of the mind. There's no distance whatsoever. In fact, really, the conscious being is the only thing that is there.
Okay. So you can't know this Atman in a thought. You can only be it. Is that right?
No, not exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it might be right if I might not have totally understood your language there. Say that.
What kind of thought knows Atman other than just being
it's what we call the vritti vyapti.
Mm.
But now with. I can't get away with just saying that shorthand, though. The self, everybody, even a jnani or ajnani, your sense of self is aparoksha. It's self-evident. That's why everybody can say, I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. They're all those words are all pointing to the reality, which is Brahman, actually. That's the truth. But everybody says, I am a conscious being because I have this body. That's the ajnanam. All of these conclusions, I'm a conscious being, which is the nature of my mind. So I am my mind. There's this aviveka, right? This lack of discrimination between the conscious being and the mithya, the thoughts and perceptions and physical body and whatnot that allow for this mistaken identification, taking the superimposition. So now what has to happen is the teaching has to go in and make you do, this is a subject-object differentiation where if I can illumine something and be aware of it and watch it come and go, I'm not that. So I have these teaching methodologies are meant to make me distinguish between me, the satya me, the one that is not changing, and the things that I've erroneously identified with as myself. So if I can just sit quietly for a moment and, for instance, watch my thoughts, and I recognize these thoughts all come and go, but I remain. What is it that remains? That's the self-evident me. And so there's all these teaching methodologies to make me differentiate what is stable and changeless from what is coming and going. And then I recognize, oh my gosh, I don't change. Nothing happens to me. I'm always the same because I've differentiated. You start out without that differentiation because you just take yourself to be the changing mind because the changing mind is always enjoying consciousness, but you don't recognize that the changing mind as it comes and goes, the conscious being doesn't. So these are differentiations you have to recognize, the mind has to recognize.
When you see it, is it a thought? Is it a perception? Or is it just beingness or knowingness?
What you do, there's a perception, there's a vritti that takes place that allows the mind to recognize its differentiation from the consciousness that illumines it. The consciousness that illumines it doesn't require a vritti. It's always there. Mm-hmm. But the vritti is required to differentiate me, the stable one that is always there, that is its own light, from all of the misidentifications that happened on the part of the mind. It's the mind that's got the problem. Consciousness is always the same, it's always illuminating whatever thought is there, whether it's a knowledge thought, an ignorant thought, doesn't make any difference. Whatever the thought is there, that thought's being illumined.
So that's a vritti or not a vritti?
The luminary, the Atma, is not a vritti, but it's the self of every vritti. But it itself is not a vritti. It doesn't require a vritti. It's self-evident.
So it could be said it's silence, Atma, consciousness, witness, those words, Sakshi.
When we use the word
that are not at all vrittis.
When we use the word Sakshi, the witness, we're using that in the Drik Drisha Viveka, the seer seeing differentiation, to show that there's, in the end, even the mind is illumined. The mind itself is known. And we say that's the Sakshi, by the witness. Then we say the mind is known. By who? By who is the mind known? Then we say that's the Sakshi. The mind is illumined by the Sakshi, by the witness. The Sakshi is a word for the Atma here. But then when you remove the object that is known from the Sakshi is not a Sakshi anymore. It's just consciousness. Because consciousness isn't doing any act of illumining, it just is consciousness. But we call it a Sakshi in order to differentiate it from the mind. It becomes the Sakshi of the mind, but you get rid of the mind because the mind is the object. Then the Sakshitvam, the state of being a Sakshi for the Atma, you realize it's not a Sakshi. I'm not a Sakshi. I am just a conscious being. And in fact, in meditation, it's a good exercise to look and to have your mind say, am I the conscious being doing anything? Am I illumining anything? Am I knowing anything? So, no. I'm just conscious being. So that conscious being that I am right now, once you recognize it, right now, that conscious being that is not performing a function but just is self-evident me, I'm not doing anything. I just am. And then with the mind, the thoughts take place and emotions take place with the body activities taking place. But my being is really, it's infinite wholeness. It's not performing a function. It's Ishwara, it's God. It's the self of Ishwara. It's the very self of its very core, the very being of the creation.
So then every thought is ignorance, mithya. You can say
every
that.
Thought is, don't say ignorance. Mm-hmm. Say mithya.
Because thoughts can be knowledge-based, which are not opposed.
Yeah.
But they're still mithya.
There's all mithya. Anything within Maya is mithya. And then when you don't want to say all thoughts are ignorance, because then we're just using the term incorrectly.
Hmm.
Say all thoughts are mithya.
That's turning off that. Yeah. I'm thinking that. Okay, thank you for all those questions.
You're welcome. It's my pleasure.
Carol, this may sound a little tangential, but I've got a 17-year-old cat that's dying, and I was wondering if it's caused me to think a little bit about what Vedanta has to say about dying. Hello. You know, more, you know, like what Vedanta resources there are out there, like books or Swami has talked.
Oh, yeah, sure. The jiva means the soul, which is comprised of the mind, which would be, you know, your intellect and your mind, your eye notion and your memory. And then your organs of action, or your hand, that what enlivens the body and all the prana. And then all of your sense organs, so the mind, the sense organs, the prana, and what enlivens the body. There's 19 components. That makes up the subtle body. That's what we call the jiva. That, and of course the jiva has, the Atman doesn't transmigrate. Yourself is always the same. So now, based upon your karma, you will, from beginningless time, be taking body after body after body. Sometimes you'll take an animal body. Like Tibby, she's a jiva. She's a jiva. She's taking this body in order to exhaust some karmas. But she could have had many, it's beginningless, many, many human bodies. See, we're talking about you. Many, many human bodies, deva bodies, devata bodies. But just in this particular incarnation, all that Tibby's doing is burning off some karma, because that free will only belongs, that they say in the Shastra, the free will in order to accrue new karma only is in this human upadhi. So it's not that she doesn't have emotions and feelings and relation, she is all of that. But she's not, we say she's not accruing karma. She's just exhausting karma. And so she's here, and I'm so lucky to have her. We have some karma together. There's no way, you know, just like with your cat, 17 years, there's some karma together. It's really very special. And so now, 17 years, she's had a full life. She's ready to move on. And so who knows? Because the jiva components are exactly the same. We all have the same components. You know, but when we take different upadhis, there's more or less limited or more exalted expression. You know?
So accruing karma is basically for human.
Accruing karma, yeah.
Yeah.
If we take an animal body, we're exhausting, just exhausting. And so she'll pick up where she left off, or whatever there was this karma to be lived through. Mm-hmm. And then when she drops her body, then she could take another, come back as a human. Mm-hmm. Or they even, I don't know where I've heard this, you know, if they can even take another animal body. Maybe she wants to be with you some more, to take another animal body.
But by accruing karma, what do you mean exactly?
That's okay, so.
Oh, okay. Go at it then, Tibby.
That's a
No, what we mean by that is there's three types of karma. One's the prarabdha karma. That's the karma that causes you to take this birth and will take you all the way through to your death. Mm-hmm. While you're exhausting that karma, there's what we call the agami karma. Those karmas are karmas that are being accrued now, because you have free will, you can make decision, you can do dharma or adharma. So you can accrue karmas. That karma goes into what we call the sanchitta karma, where all of your karmas that have not yet fructified in the prarabdha karma are being stored. And so all the agami karmas, for the most part, will go in as punya or papa, into the sanchitta. And then, depending upon the trajectory of this life, when your prarabdha is over, you drop this body, then what they say is the thought that you have when you die is kind of a culminating thought that you don't have any control over it, really. Your life, because you lose your will, you know, when the body goes. That will is gone, and so whatever the culminating thought of your life is what sends you on that next trajectory. And the karmas that are appropriate for that next trajectory, that next life, is what you'll attract. Mm-hmm. Those are the karmas that will be used for the prarabdha karma. Mm-hmm. You know, just like in this life, you can see, you know, we're drawing on different capacities and different skills that we have that take us into the next moment. That keeps going. And so for your cat, now that she's coming to the end of her life, is it a girl or boy?
It's a girl, yeah.
Yeah, she's coming to the end of her life. You know, then she will drop this body and be back into that sphere where you know a lot more than you do here. They say, you know, when you drop the body, then you're in a more subtle plane and you have much longer recognition of all of your lives. Mm-hmm. You know, and that will last for some time. I don't know all of the details of it, but then your karmas will take you into eventually having another human birth. She could also spend time in different lokas exhausting karma. Karma, but not from this life. Because this life she's exhausting. Mm-hmm. But she could have other experiences on other lokas, just exhausting karma until she takes another body here. Mm-hmm. And that body here could be a human body, or if she's has more animal bodies to exhaust, she can do that. But it's not as though you start out as an animal and then you become a higher animal and then you become a human and then it's like this. It's all it's just all the exhaustion of karma. We've all been all kinds of animals and devatas and all kinds of human beings, you know.
Trees and insects?
Trees and insects, worms.
They all have the Jivas. What did you say, 17 things that make up?
Yeah. But yeah, the 19 components. But the physical upadi doesn't allow for a full expression of all of those. Like, say, for a person born blind. It's the physical eyes that are blind. It's not that they don't have the sense of sight on a subtle level. Mm-hmm. You know? Or if you lose your hearing now, you still have, on a subtle level, your sense of hearing, but the ears aren't working. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now look at it in terms of an upadi. You can have an exalted human upadi that's so athletic, or you can be one who's not athletic at all. You know, it depends on the upadi you've taken. Or then you can have an animal body that has, you know, in some ways from a human standpoint, limited in some ways and very exalted in other ways. I mean, animals can do so much that we can't do. They're so extraordinarily sensitive in ways that we can't even imagine, actually. Mm-hmm. You know?
Thank you, that's very helpful.
Yeah. Have you had her the whole 17 years?
About 11.
11?
Tiz and Maya, I'm taking care of her.
Well, animals are very special.
I've grown very attached.
Oh, yeah. I know. I understand. They deserve that type of bond, you know.
Skinnier.
Is she scared?
She looks skinnier.
Or skinnier? She might be a little skinnier. I've been exercising her more and she's dieting a little bit. She's getting a little hefty. She's getting paunchy.
Don't they seem half human?
They are, though. They're the same. They are. They're Atma. Mm. You know, it's the same Jiva. It's the Jiva, just like us. Mm. But Titty's got her own special little upadi there.
Their ears.
Yeah. We love you.
Yeah. Ananda.
Ananda. What kind of cat is she?
I think she's a Maine Coon cat. It's a black and white.
Uh-huh.
You know, the white mane kind of.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Very cute.
Yeah. You'll miss her.
Well, you know, 17 years is a pretty long time.
Pretty long
cat
time.
Years.
It is. Yeah. She did well.
So you can multiply it by 7?
Yeah, something like that.
That's pretty old.
How old is
my dog?